Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online at thepromiseoftomorrow.biz. An exciting show today. We have with us Alan Marshall. He's speaking at PitCon. Fascinating guy. You're going to love every minute of it. PitCon is going on in Chicago at McCormick Place, March 2 through the 6th. You can know more at pitcon.org. Major General Scott Rice is going to stop in and 20th Century Border Energy Forum, and we'll visit the Den of Strangers, our fountain of useless information, in the second half of the program. At the end of the show, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's get to our guest.
Stand by.
Well, as you know, PitCon is coming back again. It's going to be March 2 through 6 at the McCormick Place in Chicago, and we're giving press coverage to it. We're lucky today we have with us Alan Marshall. He's professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Florida State University. He's also director of the Ion Cyclotron Resonance Program. I'll get it out. Cyclotron Resonance Program, National High Magnetic Field Laboratory, and we're really lucky to have him. He's going to have two presentations at PitCon, and I hope today he can kind of give us a preview of what we're looking for. Welcome to the program, Alan.
There are two talks. One is to discuss Centers for Chemical Innovation, which is a National Science Foundation initiative that supports large facilities over a period of years to develop new techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is a talk at an award symposium for Michael Roper, who's getting a separations award, and we'll talk about some things that we do that bear on that.
All right. Excellent. Well, let's kind of take them one at a time. Transform ion cyclotron resonance user facility, instrumentation, that sort of thing. First of all, let's get down to the very basics here. What are we talking about, an ion cyclotron resonance? What is that all about?
Sure. So this goes way back. When you put an ion in a magnetic field, it rotates at a frequency, the so-called cyclotron frequency,
mm-hmm.
and that's related to the mass of the ion. And so we can measure that frequency to eight places, so that makes this the most accurate way to measure mass, and it's useful for looking at complex mixtures where we can identify tens of thousands of compounds at once in terms of their chemical formula.
Tens of thousands of compounds at once. Now, how is that useful?
Well, the mass of a molecule uniquely defines its elemental composition, so it tells you the number of carbons, hydrogens, oxygens, nitrogen, sulfur, and so on. So, for example, for petroleum or oil spills, we can identify 50,000 different chemical compositions in a single sample in a single spectrum.
Oh, I see. So if we're talking about an oil spill and somebody brings in a sample to you, you can tell from that single sample. How big does a sample have to be before you can get all these different elements identified?
About a 20th of a drop would be plenty. And basically every kind of petroleum is different. So we can tell an oil spill that came from one place apart from something that seeped out of the ground somewhere else.
All right. Now, why is that important? I mean, if there's an oil spill in the Baltic, it probably came from Russia or something. And if there's an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, it may have come from us. Why is that important?
Well, let's say you're British Petroleum and it's the Deepwater Horizon spill, and mm-hmm. somebody finds a tar ball on their beach and they'd like to know if it's BP's fault or not. So we can tell.
Okay. So
natural seeps in the Gulf. So the BP oil spill was about 5 million barrels, but a million barrels a year leaks out of the Gulf anyway from other places, so we can tell which is which.
Oh, all right. You're saying there's natural leakage of oil into our oceans, and that will form tar balls anyway, whether we're drilling or whether we're not. And so if somebody wants to claim that they've got the damage or something from the BP oil spill, you have to be able to tell that it's from BP and not from natural leakage. Is that right?
Sure. We did a similar thing. There was a Costco Busan was an oil tanker that ran into the Oakland Bay Bridge in about 5 years ago, and we could tell which tank in the tanker was the oil that washed up on the particular beach.
That's pretty fascinating stuff. Now, wait a minute. Though the oil that is seeping into the Gulf of Mexico, wouldn't one presume that that's the same oil that is being drilled by BP? I mean, how is that different?
Well, they're different formations. So some were made at different time out of different kinds of plant materials. Bacteria have evolved over 70 million years, so depending when they ate the oil ate the leaves to produce the oil, the composition of the final oil will be different.
Okay. This sounds like really, really deep science. How long have you been able to do this sort of identification?
Well, we started about 15 years ago, and we were interested because oil was the most complex mixture we knew of. But it turned out that we could identify deposits before they form in the pipes, so that was sort of interesting to the oil companies. We've looked at emulsions. It takes 7 barrels of water to make a barrel of oil out of the ground, so you end up with a lot of dirty water. And the question is, how do you get that apart? So there's a lot of interest in oil-water emulsions, and we can tell you what will stabilize the emulsion or not, things like that.
Now, is that what useful for cleanup after an oil spill? Is that the point?
Well, the more you know about the oil, the more you know what to do about it, I guess, would be the short answer. So the deposits, for example, that's like cholesterol in your arteries before it deposits, on the walls of the vessels. So if you know what's going to deposit in the oil pipe, then you can put additives in that will prevent it from happening.
Well, now then, are you also involved with this? Yes. Hello. Can you hear me now? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Are you also involved then with the chemicals that are put into the oil spills that eat the Eat the oil and have it fall to the bottom so that the spill never becomes dangerous?
Well, yeah, they're additives. They're detergents like Corexit that Nalco makes. They put about 2 million gallons of that in the spill to disperse the oil. So we can detect that in the ocean. Sounds easy, but when it gets diluted enough, then the organic matter that's already in the ocean becomes as abundant as the detergent, but we can still tell them apart. Looked at that. There are also people trying to train bacteria to eat the oil, so we're looking at some of those to see how well they work.
Well, I thought we already had trained bacteria to eat the oil, and that's kind of what I was asking about. Are you part of developing that bacteria?
No, those are microbiologists, but there's a company called Taxon in California, for example, who's trying to find bacterial consortia. The bacteria that eat oil aren't just one species. You can't culture them one at a time because each one depends on the other one for its food. So they are trying to find the minimum number of bacteria which, when combined, will eat the oil.
Okay. Is this something that's kind of exclusive to what you're working on? I mean, does it have it certainly has a commercial applications, certainly, but you're at Florida State University. So is the university getting involved in commercially marketing these techniques and things around the world?
To a little extent, but mainly still publishable research. We formed something we call Future Fuels Institute, which is 4 oil companies that each contribute $250,000 a year, mm-hmm. and in return we work with them on projects of joint interest. So that's publishable stuff, but there will be intellectual property coming out of that and commercializable things.
All right. Well, that's fascinating. And what sort of a time frame are you seeing before this becomes commercial so that people in the Mediterranean and other places like that will be wanting to use these techniques?
Well, some of it's already been patented. For example, this identifying these deposits, that's now a published patent. And we're trying to work on the emulsions and those things. So this Future Fuels Institute started just this year, January, and so it'll run for a few years, and we'll see where we get.
All right. Now, when you make this presentation at PITCON, what do you hope is the takeaway from this particular talk? And I'm talking about this one, and then we'll get on to the next one that you're going to be doing.
Well, we're a national user facility, so the basis of that is that we have permanent staff and enough experts that when anything new happens in our area, we can implement it immediately, whereas other people have to wait a couple of years till they can buy something. So in that two-year window, we bring in about 100 users a year who come here because we're the only place they can do that particular technique.
Okay, and so the idea is that you want to educate everybody that will come and listen to your talk and let them know what your capabilities are and what can happen. And I suppose you're looking for some partners or you're looking for people that are users.
Sure, and also to let them know how we operate. I mean, most places work with permanent staff. We actually have students and postdocs who are working with these outside users as a method. Very few places do it that way. So we want to show them how we operate to see if they're interested to do something similar.
All right. Well, that's some pretty fascinating stuff, Alan. Now let's get on to the other talk that you're going to do. You started to explain it early in the program, and quite frankly, I kind of went over my head a little bit. So brief us on that.
Well, the other one is separations. That symposium is about separation. So, as far as just separating things, we can do it better than any chromatograph. What we can't do is observe high dynamic range. So if there's something present that's more than 1,000 or 10,000 times more abundant than what you're interested in, we'll never see the low abundance component. So that's where we couple with chromatography, because the liquid chromatograph separates the abundant ones from the less abundant ones, and then we're able to make more ions out of the less abundant ones so that we get the same number of ions for everything. I don't know if that's clear, but it basically overcomes this dynamic range. So blood and urine, for example, the dynamic range is 12 orders of magnitude. So to see the, you can remove 99.9% of the the albumin from blood, and it's still more abundant than anything else in there, almost. So you need a chromatograph or something to get rid of the abundant component, or to separate the abundant component so you can look at the other ones.
Okay, and so that's what this particular technique does then. It allows you to get rid of the massive stuff that you've got all over the place and easy to find, and lets you drill down to the very minute particles that you really want to identify. Is that right?
Sure. And the second aspect is that, let's say, we can tell exactly what atoms are in the molecule, but let's say there's an oxygen atom. We don't know if it's an alcohol or ketone or carboxylic acid or ether, but liquid chromatography can certainly separate those. So it helps us identify structural aspects, whereas the mass only tells you the chemical formula.
Okay, so this would be useful in medicine and in crime detection, both?
Absolutely, and we do biomarkers. We're doing looking at modifications of proteins, looking at protein complexes. Any complex mixture is really what we focus on.
Is this stuff pretty pervasive right now, or are you just introducing this into the marketplace?
Well, initially we had a lot of this field to ourselves. Then the Orbitrap came along, which does a lot of what we do. We still are about 10 times higher resolution, but you can do a lot of what used to be only we could do things, and a lot of those now you can do with Orbitrap. And there are thousands of those out there. There are hundreds of FTICR instruments. There are thousands of Orbitrap.
Okay, well, now then, let's take this one at a time. Crime detection. How is this going to be practically useful to the local constabulary?
Well, one we published a number of years ago is explosives. You don't need us to tell that there's TNT, let's say, but if you look at the wrapping and packing of around the explosive and you compare what's at the crime scene with what's in the guy's garage that you suspect, then we could tell whether they're the same. So that kind of thing. It's comparisons. You want to compare the crime scene with some source. Similarly with arson, we looked at we lit fire to a couch that we had put various accelerants on, various hydrocarbon lighter fluid and things like that, and we could tell which accelerant was used based on the residue afterward. So things like that.
And then, of course, you've got the suspect, and the police have the suspect, and they go to the suspect's garage or basement, and they find the same accelerant, and you can say, no, this is exactly the same accelerant. It's not accelerant that was used by somebody else, but this was the accelerant that was used in this particular crime. Is that right?
Right. We only looked at half a dozen. You'd need to do a few hundred to, you know, cover the ground, but we showed that in principle that kind of thing should be possible.
Okay, so you could take, like, say the Boston bombing and look at the residue from that particular bomb and then go compare it to bombs making material that might be in the basement of the home of the suspect and be able to testify in court that that they are the same, they came from the same batch.
Have not done that, but in principle should be possible, yeah.
Okay, so... What would if a jury were to, a defense attorney were to say, well, how could you be so sure that it's the same stuff? Because there could be the same type of explosives or accelerant or whatever there happens to be bought from, let's say, the same Home Depot and kept in somebody else's basement.
Well, it's a little tricky because sometimes different brands of, say, lighter fluid may be exactly the same chemically, but they're sold under different labels. And things that claim to be the same could be different. So it gets a little tricky. But think of it like a fingerprint. What makes a fingerprint useful is that it's complicated, all those ridges and whorls. And what makes complex mixtures easy to identify is that they're complicated. So the more components they have, the easier it is to tell them apart.
Wow, okay.
As long as you can resolve and identify all the components.
Yeah.
Resolve them.
Yeah, okay. Now then, in medicine, tell us how the applications of this would be in the field of medicine.
Well, let's see. Biomarkers, we looked at biomarkers for Alzheimer's and from cerebral spinal fluid. So it turns out that there are proteins in the cerebral spinal fluid, and they have sugars on them. And where the sugars are and which ones they are tell you whether you're sick or not. So we could identify the disease before you could tell by other methods, let's say.
Okay, so you would be able to study spinal fluid and maybe be able to tell if this person has a propensity to develop Alzheimer's, but it would only be the ability to develop Alzheimer's, but not really that the person is going to develop it, or is it more exact than that?
We don't know yet. And actually, biomarkers are overrated. Most of them don't work very well. The number of them that have been licensed by the FDA that were discovered by mass spec is still zero. And the reason is it's not enough just to show that something is present in disease and not normal. You have to prove that it's not present in any other disease. You have to prove that the normal is the same for men, women, old, young, depending what you ate, all that kind of stuff. But what you can do is if there's a treatment, you can monitor that same person over time with that treatment, and those differences are real because they must have come from the treatment. So that's where I think these biomarkers will be really useful.
Well,
in diagnosing disease, but in monitoring the validity of the treatment, the efficacy of the treatment.
Stephen Carr at MIT and Harvard is working on proteomics. I don't know if you know Steve or not, but does proteomics play a role in the things that you're doing?
Absolutely, and the genome is known. We know the DNA, but obviously different cells are different, disease is different from normal, and that's because the proteins that come out are modified after the DNA makes them. So proteomics is to try to figure out what all those modifications are and the relative abundances of all the proteins, and then that's what tells you what makes cells different from each other and how they behave. So we're very good at identifying those post-translational modifications because we can put the whole protein in the gas phase at once and then chop it up and know and be sure which modification came from which part of the molecule.
All right. Give us kind of a look down the road into the future, if you wouldn't mind a little bit, Alan. What do you see coming from all of this? I mean, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road. Put on the meditation cap here for just a minute and give us a peek.
Well, okay. One is that, let's say we know the genetic code. We know which proteins can be made, potentially, but it doesn't tell you which ones will be made. What determines that are small proteins called histones, and depending on their modifications, that determines whether the protein associated with that part of the DNA will be manufactured. So people call this epigenetics. It's the next level of the genetic code that tells you which proteins actually are going to show up and how they'll be modified. So that's a big project. That's like the genome in scale. So that'll be, the genome was $30 billion, I think, dollars over 15 years. This will be something like that to do something similar for proteins.
Wow. So you're looking at something on the scale of the genome project, only doing it with proteins, and in a time frame. What do you see as a time frame on this?
Decades. I mean, it took 10, 20 years to do DNA.
Okay.
There are, 22,000 genes in humans. The number of possible proteins that could be made from all those genes is like, the number of atoms in the universe. It's just statistically unthinkably big. Not all the possible ones are made, of course, but if you don't know in advance, there are that many things to look for.
Wow, so you're going to map all this on a scale of what is happening with the Genome Project. That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, people are starting to do that. There are protein databases now that go up to hundreds of thousands of proteins that are modified in different ways, and that will continue.
Okay, so with these talks you're giving at PitCon, is there one particular a takeaway you want people to walk away with, a lasting message you want to deliver when you meet there?
I guess mainly that you don't have to be afraid of chemical complexity as long as you can resolve all the components.
That sounds reasonable. Okay, very good. Well, Alan, before we get out of here, how about a word of wisdom, something that maybe a mentor gave to you as you were coming along in your field, or something that you might tell a younger person that is developing a valuable life lesson that you have learned, something you'd really like to that's really profound that you can leave us with today?
Well, one would be that don't try to pick a project because it looks easy, because they all turn out to be hard anyway. So you might as well work on something important, because it won't be any harder.
I love it. That's terrific. I have a good friend there you might know. Harry Croteau is a dear friend of mine. You know Harry?
We we've co-authored some papers with him recently.
Oh, is that right? Great. I've known Harry for a number of years when first studying nanotechnology back in the middle of the last decade. Of course, Nobel Prize winner in that regard, so that's very good. Well, when you see Harry, you have to tell him Colonel Mason said hello. So,
okay, will do.
Yeah, his wife Margaret is a doll too, so very good. Well, Alan G. Marshall, professor of chemistry, biochemistry at Florida State University and director of the Ion Cyclotron Residence Program, the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory. You're so kind to be with us. You're making your presentations, two presentations at PitCon, going on at McCormick Place, March 2 through 6, and generous with your time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, of course, we're covering the affairs that's going on at the Homeland Security Technology Conference, the middle of November, and one of the major speakers there is Major General L. Scott Rice. He's the Adjutant General for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I almost said the state of Massachusetts, but I know they want to be known as the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and we're highly honored to have him with us today. This is a veteran of, Bosnia, Kosovo, Kuwait, Iraq. One time he flew the A-10 Thunderbolt 2. Welcome to the program, General Rice.
Hey, thank you, Colonel. Thank you for having me here. This is great business and great time to be in the armed service.
And yes, we have plenty to talk about, General. We'll be right back with Major General Scott Rice in the second half hour. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
All right, this is Tom Peters. Always avoid analysis paralysis. Action, any action, is always better than ready, aim, aim, aim.